Welcome to RC Hangar Time, a podcast dedicated to the radio-controlled aviation hobby, where each week, our hosts discuss everything from airplanes to helicopters and everything in between.
All right, welcome to RC Hangar Time. This is episode number 61. Tonight we've got CPO with us and myself, Dustin. Wade's stuck on an airplane somewhere in an airport, and Mike got caught up in some family basketball stuff, so we'll try to get them on next week. But CPO and I will try to record a show and get some good information out, and I guess we'll just jump into it.
Sounds good.
CPO, you want to start off with what you did last week?
Yeah. So I got fat on lots of turkey. I'm still eating turkey. Like every meal now since Thanksgiving is some iteration of turkey leftover. So I think we're just about down to being out of leftover hell. But yeah, so RC related, I didn't get a lot done. And the weather actually has been really nice around here lately, but you know, I had family in town. My father-in-law's here. My mother, you know, came in from, Colorado. So, I pretty much took an RC sabbatical for the most part. I didn't really try and force, anything. And we've been so active, had lots of friends over for Thanksgiving and all that. So, I did get a couple things done. The one thing probably most exciting and RC related is on Tuesday, I managed to get my license, my ham radio license. So now I'm totally legit when it comes to FPV and flying certain frequencies and power levels for FPV. I actually ended up getting my general class license.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, you know, you're only required to have a technician's license. So they have three levels of license for those of you who are listening that aren't really sure about how this works. There's three levels of licensing. There's four if you include unlicensed. So unlicensed, you can use like your, you know, cellular telephones and your routers and all that stuff that's FCC certified for unlicensed use, which is all the low power stuff. And you can actually get low power FPV gear that is certified for use by an unlicensed person. But once you get into the licensing, the first level is technician, then you have general, and then after that is extra. And basically what you get by moving up the ladder is more access to certain bands and frequencies. But really, technician gets you almost everything. And then when you go to general, you get access to some HF frequencies that the technician doesn't have access to. And then when you get to extra, you get just a little bit more, not even a lot more. But technician, as far as FPV and most ham radio operators can do just about everything they want normally on with a technician class license only. So I went ahead and took a crash course myself, just self-studied, and decided that I was going to go ahead and just take two. You can basically take all three tests in one sitting if you wanted to, but I don't really have an interest to do extra. But I thought, hey, general, that gives me some cool opportunities if I really wanted to get into ham radio, which has been a new interesting area I've been exploring since I've been learning about it. But I sat down. It's a 35 question test for the technician class license, and basically you just, you know, you can memorize the questions and answers. The pool is all available online. The government publishes all the questions and all the right answers, including the distraction answers, so you can literally just study and go in and pass the test. So I took the technician, passed that, went in, took the general, another 35 question test, passed that. And then they tried to convince me to take extra, and I'm like, no way, I'm out of here. Extra is like 50 questions, and there's a lot of new concepts I learned along the way. So it was definitely an education. But do you have your license, by the way?
No, I studied for it, and I did kind of the same thing. I printed off the pool of questions, and there's a bunch of guys at my work that have the, you know, their ham licenses, and they all do radios, and they're all, you know, buddies. They're part of a ham club. And so they tried to get me to go to a class down at one of the universities here, and I signed up, and then I wasn't able to go, and I haven't done it. And there, I mean, you can't take it online, right? I want
to
make sure.
No, you have to do it. It has to be proctored by at least three people. Okay. They take it very seriously.
So I think the last time I looked at it, when I bought my Fat Shark setup, you know, I planned on doing it. It's just one of those things I haven't got around to doing yet either. So
yeah,
I need to get it done, and I probably would encourage everybody else to do it also.
You know, it really, I'm glad I did it. And like I said, it opened up a whole new, unfortunately, a new expense, because since then I've gone out, I've bought a little, an HT, a handy talkie is what they call it, a handheld radio, that runs on the 2 meter and 70 centimeter bands. So I've been connecting to and listening to and actually talking to people all around Maryland on this little, you know, radio. And it's just been kind of fun. I don't know, the actual ham radio, like talking to people and just listening to their conversations, doesn't thrill me that much. It's, you know, it's like I can watch, you know, I can see how people's weeks went on Facebook. I, you know, sit and hear people talk all day about, you know, what they've been doing and all this stuff. Yeah, I don't know, but there is some interest in taking advantage of the technology, like communicating with the, you can communicate with a technician class license. You can communicate with the International Space Station, for example.
Oh, cool.
Or you can bounce communications off of satellites as they pass overhead. So there's all these videos of people on YouTube, like you've got a certain window of like seconds to minutes that you can communicate using a satellite that's passing over. And there's websites that tell you how to track the satellite, when it's going to be, where it's going to be. And you get your directional antenna and point it at it, and you kind of follow it across the sky and communicate with people all over the world. So that kind of stuff is kind of fun. And there's a lot of contesting that people do to see how many contacts they can make in a certain amount of time, you know, and you're basically just logging call signs and all that as you talk to people. And then of course they also have the internet connected component. So there's the internet radio linking project, and there's also Echo Link, and I think there might be one more, where basically you use your ham radio to talk through the airwaves, but then those radios are connected to receivers or repeaters that are also internet connected, and you can jump nodes. Like I can connect to a repeater here from my little handheld radio sitting in my car and jump through the internet to a repeater in Australia, for example, and talk to somebody in Australia. So there's some kind of interesting stuff there that I've been playing with, but primarily, you know, I did it because, you know, of course we all know that once you start dabbling in FPV, you're playing in frequencies and wattages, that, you know, make it number one worth kind of knowing, what you're doing and how not to interfere with other people and how to get the best performance from your system. But also, you know, if the FCC decides they want to start cracking down, it's probably a good idea to get licensed. But, so it was worth doing, and it was easy. I don't know if it's like this for everywhere, but my local ham radio club gives the license testing for free. Hmm. So, I mean, I literally just showed up, no cost to me. I take a test, I pass it. I take another test, I pass it. My license you're not technically licensed until your name shows up in the FCC database, which happened like literally the next day. So I was basically immediately, for all intents and purposes, licensed, and it didn't cost me a dime. It just took me a little bit of time of study. I basically, you know, for about the week prior, just started going through the test questions over and over and over again, And then I was worried because I went to the general test as well. I had to study for those questions, which is a whole different pool of questions. So I was looking at a pool of about 600 total questions, and I was concerned actually that I was going to end up getting my general class and failing my technician class, which basically renders you without a license at all, because you have to have a technician and a general to be general classified. So, but yeah, I mean, and then also my local club, if you pass your technician class license, they give you a free membership in their amateur radio club for 1 year. So I may go check it out.
It's just one more hobby to distract you.
Why not? I mean, I have money falling from the vents in my, you know, in my office here. So, yeah. But my radio, I went bare budget, like cheap China radio. It's Baofeng GT3, for those of you who are interested. I think like $36 I paid for this thing, with a car charger and a desktop charger. And, you know, it's just kind of fun to experiment. I figured, well, hey, I'm a ham radio guy now. I should play with a radio. So I bought one. What the heck?
The guys at my work that do the ham radio stuff, I mean, their radios are like $200-$300.
Oh, and
That was something that kind of was like, yeah, I don't really want to get into that.
It can get crazy. And, and I've even been thinking about, I had these like delusions of grandeur. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to set up this base station with a huge antenna on the roof, and I'm going to put a mobile unit in my car. And, I kind of want to do all that. So I was, I had a CB back in the day. I'm into that stuff kind of. But the real answer is I'm actually more interested in pursuing it. And I'm learning it for this reason. I'm trying to figure out all of my communication mechanisms that are available to me, including you can connect. There are some repeaters that will let you connect to an actual phone system, so you can dial a phone number from your radio and make a phone call through the ham radio system. But all that said is, in case of an emergency, like a natural disaster or an unnatural disaster, such as we've seen, from time to time, particularly, 9/11 is a great example of that, where all communication shuts down. Guess what? The ham radio guys are the ones that know what's going on, because they're still up and running while the cell phones are down.
Yeah, that's true.
So I thought about it. I'm like, you know what? I'll learn this radio. I'll figure out the ins and outs, learn the craft. And then who's to say, it's not a bad idea to buy two more of these little $30 radios. Keep one in my wife's van. I'll keep one with me. We'll keep one here at the house. And if there's ever an emergency and we're separated and all the communications are down, we can have a plan that says, look, if all else fails, go to this frequency on your radio and let's try and find each other on that frequency and at least have a way to reconnect electronically. So we'll see.
Well, while we're on that kind of disaster thing, just recently, like the middle of last month, I actually did a CERT training, and that was kind of the one thing they brought up too about communications and radios and stuff like that, and that kind of sparked my interest a little bit too. But now hearing you, I think it sparked my interest a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, there's tons of YouTube videos. With people talking, giving advice on just having, ham communications. And to be frank, if it's an emergency situation, you don't even need a license to use them. I mean, that's the one exception to everything, is if it's an actual emergency, use whatever mechanism you can to communicate. So for that reason, I can give my wife a handheld, ham, radio on a, 70 centimeter or 2 meter band, which technically she would have to have a license to use. But if she doesn't use it, unless it's an emergency, then no harm, no foul. But there's lots of videos of preppers. The preppers really, they talk about their go bags and their get home bags. And, all these guys are buying these radios, and just keeping them in their bags or in their cars. And, it's not a bad idea. I'm gonna keep one with me when I go camping. And thought, hey, sometimes you get out in the boonies, you don't have cell phone signal, but with a ham radio, I could hit a tower and at least get somebody to talk to me to help me.
Yeah, for sure.
So anyway, so that's the the big thing probably that happened to me, which was kind of cool. The big expense that happened to me just today, as a matter of fact, and I knew this was coming, and I posted it on Facebook right away. But I finally broke down and bought some Fat Shark Dominator V2s.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and it was a hard pill to swallow. Those are not cheap, and you're not going to find them on sale anywhere. I mean, there's no Black Friday deals or Cyber Monday deals on. Trust me, I looked on Fat Shark goggles, but you know, I started looking at it, getting ready to build an FPV quad. I've talked about it. Matter of fact, I was chatting with the Ready Made RC guys. I think they're going to be shipping my gear here pretty soon. So I'm like, my gear here pretty soon. Like, you know, maybe now's the time to go ahead and jump in and get some goggles. And, you know, I looked at the different options, but the Fat Sharks with the built-in DVR is handy, because I actually priced external DVRs, and they're more expensive than I expected for one that really works well with FPV, because not all DVRs can handle signal loss so easily.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, $100 expense right there for a quality DVR that's externally connected. So I thought, well, Dominators have a built-in DVR, so, you know, that's one third of my purchase is going to that capability. I mean, if I look at it that way, plus the modularity of being able to use the different receiver modules if I want.
Yeah, that's
the ones you have. Do you have the Dominators?
I have the Dominator HDs, and same thing with me. Okay. Is I just bought a 1.3 system, I guess a 1.2 system, and I did a lot of research on modules that would go in the Dominator HDs, and they actually have, you know, there's a module that'll still accept the legal 1.2 and 1.3 bands for the U.S. I think it's like 1280, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but I've been looking at that module for my Dominator HDs, and then have my Attitude SDs, you know, as my 5.8 system. So, you know, and then I could obviously run off of my screen and my Boss Cam system too at any time. But, you know, I got mine
on.
That's
cool.
I got mine during the pre-sale, and so I got a little bit of a discount on them, but I also waited like 6 months to get them. So, but
yeah, that's crazy. I looked for a minute at the HDs, and you know, there's the human guy part of me that wants to just get the best, you know, the first time.
Yeah.
But I really had a hard time justifying the extra cost of the HDs over the V2 Dominators. I just couldn't do it. And I know eventually the technology is going to get there. I mean, because one of the things is, right, I'm not transmitting an HD signal back.
Yeah.
But soon, you know, soon I would imagine in the next year or two tops, we're going to see high bandwidth video transmission that's going to allow us to send back real time, you know, high def signal more commonly. I mean, it's possible now. It's just not feasible either, you know, from a cost or just availability perspective. But I think eventually we're going to get to the point where the HD actually becomes relevant.
Yeah, there's no way I could drop the money they want for the DJI Lightbridge to go HD, but. It just like kind of the same thing you said. I already had the Attitude SDs and I loved them. I wanted the built-in DVR function. I wanted the bigger field of view. And that's kind of, you know, I had some money burn a hole in my pocket, and I wanted to go to that next step. And I thought I would sell my Attitude SDs. But now with my kids kind of grown up, I think I'm probably going to hold on to them. But I bit the bullet and bought the little more expensive ones. But I also got them on sale because it was the pre-order. So I think I want to say I got them $50 or $75 cheaper than they are now.
That's awesome. Yeah, it adds up quick. But, you know, it is what it is. I don't think you can be serious in the FPV side of the hobby and not eventually – want to try and move to goggles. Now I know some people can't do it. Just it doesn't, you know, they get motion sickness or whatever. I don't anticipate that's going to be a problem. Although, you know, I am taking a risk by buying goggles and then not knowing for sure, but I think they have a good return policy. I'll be like, yeah, I can't do it. Take them back. They're defective. Okay, they're not defective. I'm defective. So I'm kind of excited about that. And then the last thing I have, and I'll let you talk, but I did do my 90-day Facebook name change. So for those of you who are used to seeing me on Facebook, when I was on RC Hangar Time as a guest earlier in the summer, I was CPO Chris on Facebook. And the reason is I just want to be CPO. Unfortunately, Facebook has this really strict requirement that you're supposed to use your real name, and they don't let you use like one name names. You know, it has to be a first name and a last name. And, you know, I couldn't put like C as the first name and PO as the last name like I do on other places. It literally was just like, no, this does not work. You have to use a full name. So I put CPO Chris just to get through their little security check. But I have another Facebook account, which is Chris Poldovar, because that's my name. But that's my kind of family and friends and, you know, all my church friends. And it's just they don't care about all of my dabbling in RC. So I created a separate Facebook account just for the hobby side of me so that, you know, you guys in the hobby side don't have to hear about, you know, what I had for lunch and, you know, what party I went to or checking in at Starbucks or, you know, all that stuff that's on the private side. I just kind of keep them separate. But CPO Chris, I didn't really like it, but it was kind of the way I got my account set up. And the problem is once you set a name, you can't change it for 90 days. They have a policy that systemically it will not let you make the change. So when my 90 days was up, I thought, okay, I'm going to change it to something, you know, a little bit more meaningful. So I changed it to Chris Poldovart, my name, duh. But it had a place for the nickname, and it said show your nickname in the timeline. So I put CPO as the nickname, thinking, cool, it's going to say, you know, Chris Poldovart and then CPO in parentheses, just like it showed me on the preview. And I'm like, I can deal with that. It says my real name, but it also says CPO. I'm okay with that. So then I hit okay, put in my password, accept the name change, and then it only says Chris Poldovart on everything. CPO, the only place it showed up was on my profile, like at the very top line of my profile. Not entirely what I expected, and now I'm stuck again. You know, I was stuck for another 90 days because once I hit okay, I couldn't change it again. So I've been waiting for my 90 days to expire. I check it every day. Like, can I change my name? Nope, 90 days. Can I change my name? Well, today, finally, I checked it, and it says, what do you want your new name to be? And I'm like, oh, sweet. So then I had to do all this, you know, soul searching on what I'm actually going to call myself. And, you know, I tried all the same stuff. But the problem with Facebook is it uses like dictionary words. It won't let you use dictionary words. It will only allow one hyphen, you know, and there's just all these rules. So I finally came up with CPO from everythingcpo.com, which is who I am and what I'm about in the hobby. I just had to get creative in how I spelt it. So you'll know what I mean if you go to Facebook, but it is CPO from everythingcpo.com. Anyway, so if you're used to seeing Chris Poldovar,
I was just wondering because you spelt from FURM, and I was like, okay, but then I saw the dot KOM, so I was like, oh, okay, I got it now.
Yeah. You know, it wouldn't let me put FROM because that's a dictionary word, so I put FRUM, and then .com. It wouldn't let me do .dotcom because it recognized that as .com as a familiar term. So I changed it to a K and it let me take it. So I'm like, phonetically, it makes perfect sense. But if you look at it, it might boggle your mind for a second. So just say it out loud and it will make sense.
Right on.
I'm sneaky that way. So anyway, so I've said way too much about me. What do you have going on this last week?
You know, just like you, I spent time with family doing the Thanksgiving thing. We went back and forth a couple of different days, and I took a couple of days off work and, you know, just hung up some Christmas lights and did some stuff. But one project that I've had, and I've had all the parts to do it, I just needed to kind of put it together. And I posted some pics on the Facebook page, but I finally started working on my charge box. And so, I got a spiral cut bit so I could actually drill out the holes nice and mount my fans and put some grates on them on the outside so I could circulate air through the bottom of the case. I got all of my, railing mounted so that I could set my plexiglass on top. I got my power supplies all wired up and soldered and tested, and I even did a little bit of a burn-in period with them. I actually charged off of them with the way I'm going to have it now. I had to get some resistor so I could step the voltage up a little bit to 13.8, I think is what it is now. And so I wanted to kind of run them. I ran them at 12, just, you know, the way they were when I first got them. But I wanted to kind of put everything together and kind of burn it in and make sure, you know, everything works. So I cycled through some batteries and tested that, and I'm just about ready to, I've got the power supplies mounted in the bottom, I'm just ready to figure out how I'm going to get the wiring in, if I'm going to put LEDs, where I'm going to put LEDs, how I'm going to mount the charger to the plexiglass. And so I worked on that a little bit last week and kind of the week before, because I wasn't on last week's show. But as far as RC wise, that's just about as far as I've gone. I hung out at the local hobby shop for about 20 minutes last week, just talking to one of the guys when I was looking for some parts for my charge box. But other than that, I haven't touched my.
So,
what's that?
So the charge box is something I've been interested in for quite a while, but I've never really done anything with it. I've got a charging suitcase. It's, you know, just the kind of the aluminum looking one from Harbor Freight that I've got all my stuff in. But how hard is it to I'm having a hard time figuring out how to get started with what I want to do and how I want to lay out a case. What's your method there for figuring all that out, or you just winging it?
Well, so I've done a lot of research on stuff. I've been through a bunch of different server power supplies. You know, with different wattages, I've thought about going 24 volts versus 12 volts. So that was kind of my first thing is, I've done a couple of different power supplies. I didn't like exactly what I built, so I'd sell them in a local classified. We have a classified ads here, and they have an RC section, so I'd sell them. But, I settled on, these Hewlett Packard, DPS 800, power supplies, and running them off of 120 volts, you can get 900 watts. And so basically what I'm doing is I wanted a box that would fit two power supplies. One that I would run all the time that my charger would be connected to, and then a separate power supply that I could use for a buddy's power or a buddy's charger or, you know, a second charger in my box. And then, that way I could run it off my generator when I'm at the field, or if, you know, I'm at home, I could run it too and kind of supply some power to, you know, maybe myself or a buddy. From there, I went with a Pelican case because, they're all plastic and they're pretty rigid. And then I wanted to, you know, make sure that I had proper airflow. So I kind of scrounged around, and found some 12 volt, fans that weren't, you know, three phase that you would need, you know, like a speed controller for. And so I found some fans, and I found two matching fans. I found matching grates. And I kind of just, once I kind of had everything, the two fans I wanted matched, the two power supplies, the box, and then, you know, just coming up with everything else, I'm just kind of inventing how everything goes in. You know, I obviously want the power supplies to be on separate switches so I can only power one up if I need it. I can't run 24 volts with the charger I have. But having two power supplies, I can eventually go to 24 volts if I decide to go to like a, you know, a 306 duo or 308 duo or something like that. So I'm really kind of just inventing it as I go along, but you know, a couple of my friends have built charging boxes and I've done a lot of research online, and after that, now that I'm in the box, I'm just kind of winging everything. Trying to make it stay clean too.
Yeah, that's on my one of these days I'm going to do it list. But right now it's low on the priorities. But so how much do you think, if you had to ballpark your investment in the charging box, not including the chargers and not including the power supplies and the charger itself, but just the accessories you need to kind of get things put all together?
So my original charge box, I actually bought a Home Depot Husky toolbox that I was going to use. And then I stumbled across this Pelican case. I think it's the Pelican 1550. And I got it for free. It's an old case, so it's not like the nice new ones. It's a little bit older case, so the sill's a little bit different. The latches are a little bit loose, but I mean, it all holds together. So I scrounged the case. The fans I scrounged from some old surplus power supplies for a computer. And they have the nice metal grates on the outside. And the power supplies were actually brand new, but they were old school power supplies from, you know, the old ATX or the ATA cases. So they only have the 20-pin connector instead of the 24-pin connector. So I scrounged those. The two power supplies I bought off eBay from a server surplus guy, and I think I got two of those for $35.
Wow!
The plexiglass I bought from a local distributor here. I went down and bought two pieces out of his junk bin, and I think those were like $2 or $3 a piece. And then wire. You know, that's where I'm going to start getting into a little bit of the cost, is like a outlet that I can plug on the outside, some switches. I did buy two voltage meters that'll go through the plexiglass that I think I paid $5 each, so like $10 for those. I scrounged some terminals from it's crazy. You walk into the place, it's called Rielco. It's like walking back to the 50s into an electronics store. They just have like rows and rows and rows of resistors, capacitors, pots, connectors, switches. You know, I mean, the place is insane. I should take a picture next time I'm in there and post it up. But it's like,
we've got a place like that in North Baltimore.
Yeah, these guys just have anything, and they spend a lot of time salvaging from old electronics too. So if I wasn't able to scrounge some of the things myself, like the fans and the grates, I could have gotten them from them, and for fairly cheap, maybe like $5-6 a fan. But every penny I can save, it's, you know, saving me money. You know, nuts and bolts and screws and things like that, you know, they all cost a couple of bucks every time you want to buy. I'm trying to keep everything black, nice Allen head RC type screws, so that if I had to pull something out, I would already have the tools in my RC box to do so. So I'm trying to make it all kind of compatible with my other RC stuff. So that's kind of where I am with that. That's really all I've done too. So RC wise.
Cool.
I did have some RC Hangar Time news. I wanted to do a shout out for Sean Morrison. Sean Morrison. That's right. I was thinking it was Morris, but he's Sean Morrison Wakeboarding Films on our group, and I've been watching him build a bunch of scratch build stuff out of the Dollar Tree foam board. And I've been watching him build a lot of the same things that I've built in the past, and just, it's been kind of cool to see, you know, where he is at with those, and just kind of putting some stuff together himself. And he's put out a couple of videos too here and there of some of the stuff he's flown. And I don't know, I love scratch building. I think it's like one of my favorite things. to do with like Dollar Tree foam board or the Home Depot insulation, and it's just fun to see other guys have that same passion too. So I wanted to give a shout out to him for that. And then
that's cool stuff.
My other RC Hangar Time news I wanted to talk about was the voicemail box. We haven't received a voicemail yet, except for Wade doing his funny you know, joke call. But I wanted just to throw that out one more time, get the phone number out and the couple of ways to do it. If you go to our website, rchangartime.com, and go to the contact page, I have everything listed there for the phone number. I have a little call me widget for Google Voice. So if you click on that, you put in your phone number and they'll call you. So you wouldn't have to, you know, have any long distance charges or anything else. But the phone number is, if you want to just dial it, is, area code 612-361-7248. And 7248 is RC Hangar Time, so RCHT. So if you need that to help you remember. And, you know, you can leave a message. You can, if you want to leave us a comment, if you want to ask us a question, you know, just leave your name and where you fly from. And you know, we'll try to give you a shout out, or we'll try to address your questions. Or, you know, if you've got a comment, you know, that's a good constructive comment that we can apply to maybe the show. And then, you know, depending on the comment and how good the quality is, you know, maybe we'll try to get it played on the show also, so that we can, you know, share that with the rest of our listeners. So
that's awesome.
Wanted to throw that out, and whoever calls first, man, they'll be the first one.
That's one of those things that I think is going to have a few people actually take advantage of it, so that it can get some traction. Because I think once we start playing them on the air, for example, on the podcast, people will start to know, oh, hey, yeah, that's a great way I can talk to people. And I know you listen to the flight test guys, their podcast where they do the callers, and it's just kind of cool to hear other people come on and ask questions and, you know, give shout outs and stuff. So that'll be interesting when that actually takes off here.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So that's it for me. I don't really have anything else. Do you have any RC Hangar Time news or any shout outs that you wanted to do?
No, not really. There's some cool stuff on there, but nothing specifically that I want to shout out. So
okay,
I think we're good.
I think we can probably jump into our main topic if you're ready for that.
Yep.
So today we're going to be talking about pre-flight checks, what you do to your aircraft or helicopters or multi-rotors or whatever to you know, get your model in the air. So I don't have a super big ritual of the things I do, because some of the, you know, like I've said, the things that I do are you know, a lot of scratch build stuff, and I do have a couple rituals I do with my multi-rotors. But CPO, maybe you have something because you do helicopters, so maybe you want to start out.
Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, so the first thing I do is, you know, I always stand, I face south, I shake my right leg 3 times. No, my helicopters, I kind of have two types of rituals or pre-flight checks. One of them is the pre-maiden. You know, the very first time I fly it, I'm like extra cautious, going through everything. But to be honest with you, most of my pre-flight check is a lot of that same stuff. At least until I get to a point where I trust everything. I've never had a helicopter tip over on me. I've never had control surfaces reversed. I've never had gyros reversed once I get past the setup. I will admit I've had a tail gyro direction reversed on a build. But once I get past that point, I'm actually to the point where I want to fly. And I think the reason I've never had those problems, and those of you, you know, it's not unusual to not have problems, but those of you who haven't ever had a problem, it's probably because you're fairly methodical in making sure everything is right before you try and lift off. So what I do is, just check and make sure that all of my stick directions are right. So when I move the rudder stick, it's, you know, I'm getting the right movement there. When I move the ailerons and the elevator, everything is in the right direction. And then I'll literally pick up the helicopter and move it and check the gyro directions and make sure the gyro is compensating correctly in all directions. And I do that before every single first flight of the day. Now, once I've started flying, right, changing batteries and stuff, I don't go through all of that. I do a control wiggle after a battery change. So if I, you know, bring the helicopter down and then I, you know, power it off, change batteries, power it back on, I kind of do a quick just direction control, make sure that that I've got full control of the servos before I let it go, because I am aware, and this could bite somebody if they're not aware, but in a lot of these systems, the throttle is just passed through from the flight controller. Sometimes it's not even passed through the flight controller. Sometimes your throttle signal is direct to your receiver, depending on how you have things set up. So you could have a completely initialized ESC and full throttle access. Like if you bump the throttle stick, you know, up, you're going to get power to your motor, but yet your flight controller, your fly barless system in this case, hasn't fully initialized yet. So you'll have motor but no servo control. So that's always made me nervous. And so I always wait to make sure I'm getting the right tones. I get certain tones I'm used to hearing when my fly barless controller is completely initialized. And then I always kind of do the servo wiggle with the stick before I try and take off. So
yeah.
That's pretty much, and it's not very different than what I do with airplanes or probably most people. It's kind of the same stuff. It's, you know, with the exception being is I don't have, gyro necessarily. I don't have any stabilization systems on any of my airplanes. So, I'm not looking at that, but I am looking to make sure, you know, I'm giving the high fives and the handshakes and all that stuff. Making sure my stick directions match what I expect them to be. And then I'll usually bump the throttle just to make sure I've got motor before I go take it out and set it on the runway.
Yeah, that's kind of the same thing I do with planes. I kind of go through the, you know, where all my control surfaces are moving in the proper direction. And usually, you know, that's not a problem. I don't change anything mechanically between flights that would cause that problem. But, you know, some of my stuff has hinge tape, and so I always make sure that my hinge tape's good. Sometimes, depending on what the aircraft is and how crazy you fly it, I always make sure that I'm getting the same amount of throw. Like, you know, if I'm running two aileron servos, make sure that my throws kind of match. Make sure that I'm getting... You know, first off, my trims are centered, and then when I give it left throw on the rudder or the right throw on the rudder, you know, I get the same amount of, you know, travel in both direction. Same thing with the elevator. And then I always, even though, you know, most of my stuff is electric, well, I guess all my stuff is electric, I still like to, you know, hold the fuselage and just bring my throttle up all the way and just down to make sure that my prop, you know, adapter's all tight. I don't have any problems there. No big vibrations happening that would, you know, cause a failure in the air. But, you know, always checking my control surfaces. A lot of the stuff, you know, like I think everybody knows I do is scratch building. And so control surfaces sometimes are, I just have hinge tape. They're not a, you know, mechanical hinge. And so making sure that tape is all still stuck down and good or not cracked or, you know, showing any sign of wear.
Yeah. I mean, you're right, though. You kind of mentioned this, but if you're not doing a mechanical change, if you're not working on the plane or changing out components, the last time you set your control surfaces should be exactly the way it is the next time you fly. But I have this, like, it's obsessive compulsiveness where I still want to make sure they're all moving in the right direction before I take off for that first time for the day. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I check on my plane, and you brought a good point too, which is something I'm working on getting more used to doing, is checking to make sure my trims are all centered. If that's the case, like on my helicopter, I want my trim centered, but on a plane, once I do a trim flight, my trims might be just a little bit bumped. If I didn't go back in and do a mechanical adjustment, I might have actually on purpose a little bit of trim, but I try and know if that's normal or not. I've been known to bump trims while I'm carrying my transmitter, you know, from one place to the next.
Yeah. You know, one other thing I check too, along with that, is I always put my battery voltage tester on my battery before I put it in the aircraft. I've had times where I've thought I've put a charged battery in, and then I'll take something off, and then like I'll get the low voltage cut out or something, and I'm, you know, not anywhere near the landing spot, and so I'm putting stuff down in the grass, and so that became my little, you know, compulsive disorder thing, my OCD. Is I always check the battery voltage before I put it in. And then the second thing I do is I always check CG and make sure that where I place my battery, nothing has changed. You know, my CG is good. I've had some issues where I've set something up the time before maybe to run two batteries, and then I've gone back to one battery and not paid attention and had my CG off too. And, you know, tail heavy plane is never anybody's friend.
Right.
I think I think there's an old saying that, you can fly a tail heavy plane, but only once.
Yeah. Yep. That's right. So. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Now on the battery thing, actually before we go to batteries, cause I did have a couple of thoughts on batteries, but, back onto the airplane, just the services, do you check, your rates? I always tend to flip on and try and reorientate my brain with where my rate switches are and where, you know, where everything is set up, and kind of go through that movement and just check and make sure I'm able to change rates and all that. Do you mess with any of that stuff, or do you pretty much just have it?
No, I do the same thing. So I have a Spectrum radio, and so I'm also a computer guy, so zero on my radio and zero in my head is always off. And so what I'll do is I'll, you know, if I've got like, you know, elevator rate or elevon rates, you know, or, you know, some rate set up, what I'll do is I'll bring that control surface to its maximum and then cycle through my rates and make sure that, you know, it goes back to where it's supposed to be.
Yep.
You know, kind of that same thing. And then, you know, a lot of different things I fly have different rates, and or I have rates set up. So I always try to familiarize myself too. Let's see, this one I only have, you know, aileron rates, or this one I have, you know, rudder rate, or, you know, just things like that. Because some planes I have stuff set up, and some planes I don't.
Right.
So.
Yep. No, I'm exactly the same way. As a matter of fact, I haven't done it yet, but I almost am tempted to start like a little notebook or something that's just got the model and then all the things I need to know about that model, which switches control which function, because, you know, depending on the plane, I may have some things, you know, for example, my Sensei has a bomb bay door, you know, it's like, I got to remember which switch is the bomb door, you know, and, yeah. And so, and some things are going to have like my multi-rotors, I might have a return to home or a loiter switch or a, you know, whatever. And it's like, I kind of just wish I had an easy reference with my gear that I could just look at and go, okay, there's all my switches. But what I do now in lieu of that is I sit down and I start flipping the switches to go, okay, that's right. I programmed all the rates on one switch, so it does everything. But on this other plane, I might have a separate aileron and elevator rate. You know, it's like I just got to kind of play through all that stuff each time.
Wouldn't it be nice if your radio had a screen, or, you know, a way you could toggle to another screen that you could actually have notes written down inside? I mean,
well, you know, OpenTX, the newest version, is supposed to have that capability. I haven't looked at the new firmware. I've still got a little bit older firmware from earlier in the year. But my understanding was that the newer firmware was supposed to have some sort of a note screen that you could access for each programmed model that you'll be able to have like a quick rundown, which is the only one I know of that does anything like that. But
yeah, that'd be way cool.
Yeah,
and you know, you can set up with like the OpenTX stuff. You can set it up on your PC and then just upload your model to your radio, so you could spend the time typing it out, you know, and not have to fumble through characters on a scroll wheel and buttons. So
yeah, no, that makes it a lot easier. All right, so you'd mentioned batteries, and so I think there's probably some stuff to explore there as well. You talked about checking the voltages before you put them in the plane. I do that as well. I take a little. I either have one of the little voltage alarms that I'll plug in and leave on for the flight, depending. You know, I try and do that with my airplanes at least. I don't necessarily do it with my helis. I use the timer for that.
Yeah.
But for some reason with planes, I'll just kind of like fly them until the voltage alarm goes off, because there's it's a fairly consistent, you know, amp draw. Whereas the helis, I'll draw so many amps doing, you know, a certain, you know, type of maneuver that it'll set the alarm off constantly.
Yeah.
Under load. So with the planes, I don't really have that problem. So I'll usually run that. And that helps me at least when I plug that in, to know it's not beeping right away. But I also carry a little, just a voltage checker that I use. And for a while I was getting in the habit of whenever I fully charge the battery, when I'd pull it off the charger, I'd take a piece of, blue masking tape, like the painter's tape. Mm-hmm. And I would wrap around, like cover the connector on the battery, mm-hmm. so that when I use the battery, I pull the tape off, and then I know I can just look at a bunch of, you know, batteries sitting on a table, and three of them have blue tape on them and two of them don't. I know which ones have been used and which one hasn't. Mm-hmm. So that was a little thing I used to try and keep myself in check.
Cool. Yeah, I actually started. So I used to use the beeper alarm only on my multi rotors, but that's actually something I kind of do now too. Is I just leave my voltage alarm on everything. That's usually how I check. I do have a separate checker, but I usually just leave my voltage alarm on everything. More than anything is some of the planes I have are. They have Simon K flashed ESCs in them still from I've pulled them off multi-rotors, and it gets rid of the low voltage cutoff. And so, you know, you got to make sure that you know where you're at.
But yeah, it's true.
Not everything's that way, but, you know, some of the stuff I've pulled ESCs off, or I've burnt out one ESC and it left me with another one, so I'll replace them both. So I have piles of ESCs, and some of them are flashed, you know, with Simon K firmware, so I'm too lazy to go back and try to flash them back.
it is hard to go back once you've like got something set up. It's like, even if you reuse it for a different purpose, it's like, oh, I don't really want to go back and mess with it anymore. So the challenge area for me with batteries isn't the flight batteries, it's the transmitter battery, making sure that it's so easy for me to forget to charge, and thankfully I've never had a problem with it. I have got a low battery alarm on my transmitter in flight before, and I'm like, oh, it's time to bring this thing in. But I think part of the problem for me too is I have so many different transmitters. I've got a Taranis, I've got a Futaba 8FG, I've got a couple of SLT radios that I use, some Tactics, and the thing about those, which drives me crazy, is they're just AA batteries. So there's not even a way to charge. I don't have rechargeable batteries on them. I just every so often just change batteries just for general purpose. But my Futaba and my Taranis, if I know I'm going flying the next day, as I'm charging up batteries and all that stuff, I will put those either on the charger themselves, or I'll pull the batteries out of them and charge them, just put them in the cycle and charge them with everything else. But
yeah.
Do you have any tricks for making sure you always have a topped off battery?
No, I've had that same problem though. I've forgotten to look at my radio, and then I'll go out for like a day, you know, like I'm going to go out today with my buddies with a ton of planes, and we're just going to spend a good 4 or 5 hours, and I've gotten to the field, and I've turned on my radio, and maybe my first flight I get a low battery warning. On all of my radios, I've upgraded to a LiPo battery, so that I could charge it at the field if I need to, if I bring a charger with me. And then I kept the original batteries, which are the nickel metal hydride batteries, and I always keep those charged in the box so that I'll have a spare if I need to.
That's a good idea.
But, you know, on my DX9, that's my current setup. On my DX7, my original DX7, I actually upgraded it to a life battery, and so I don't have a spare life battery for it, but I could run it off of a 2-cell battery. So I always have, you know, like a 2-cell 1800 milliamp that I could put in there, and I've built a little connector that'll change it from a Deans to the connector that the original battery came with, and so I could flip-flop back that way also if I need to.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's a good idea to keep the nickel metal hydride as a always charged backup.
Yeah.
Not nearly the same problems as leaving a LiPo charged up.
Yeah. And, you know, you talk about having a couple of radios. I've actually gotten to the field when I had my DX8, and I pulled the antenna right out of the case, and I wasn't able to fix it at the field, and it was a day ender. So I actually started carrying my DX7 with me when I was going to go, you know, fly for 4 or 5 hours, so that if something did happen to my radio, I'd have a spare radio and I could program at least just something to fly. You know, I may not be able to put up, you know, my multi-rotors or something, but at least I could program it to, you know, so I could fly a wing or, you know, fly my Bixler or something else.
Yeah, that's true.
How about multi-rotor pre-check? Do you do a lot with that, or?
So the multi-rotors, there's a lot less to check, really, a lot less that you're able to check. You know, it's not like you have a control surface or servo movement that you can really look at. I usually just, power them up and, get it as flat as possible and stable as quickly as I can after applying power. Sometimes I, you know, have to pick it up, like my tricopter. I got to kind of pick it up, turn it upside down, put the power on, and then set it down while it initializes.
Yeah.
But I'll do I'll arm it and then kind of just spin it up and just like blip the throttle a little bit before I try and take off, just to make sure it doesn't want to flip over on itself. But that's really outside of GPS type stuff, making sure. I know, one of the challenges when we start talking about GPS-enabled devices is if you don't have a good GPS lock with satellites, your return to home could be fly away from home or something similar. Yeah. We've heard all kinds of stories about that. But for just general multi-rotor use, I don't really do much other than just I'm really easy on them until I realize they're not going to try and eat themselves, and then I just take off and go fly.
Yeah. So with my production style rigs, like my NASA devices and, you know, stuff I'm carrying, GoPro and gimbal and stuff with, the two big things I always do is I go over all my props and make sure nothing's cracked or split or, you know, show white lines or anything, so that I make sure that I got good props. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I always do is I always do a GPS compass calibration when I get there. Before I fly, I run through the sequence to calibrate the GPS and compass. And then
every new flight of the day, every first flight of the day.
Yeah. So every time I unload from the car to a new site, I always run the GPS, calibration and the compass calibration, just because you never know what's affecting, you know, either to a new site or if you had it next to the speakers in the car or something like that. You know, I always want to make sure that I'm calibrated for where I'm going to fly. And then I kind of do the same thing. I arm my motors, I spin them up, I make sure everything kind of spins up equal speed. You know, there's not one motor that didn't spin up while the other ones did. And then I kind of, I give it a pop up and maybe get it about, you know, eye level, and then I kind of just let it hold there. And I that's obviously after all the GPSs are locked and everything's ready to go. I pop it up about eye level, kind of just look at my blades as they spin and just make sure that, you know, nothing looks like it's waving or flopping around, or, you know, I think everything kind of sounds good and everything sounds and looks good. And then, you know, I take off with my other stuff, the stuff I have like KK2 boards, like my V-tails. I'm a little more lax on that. The one thing I always do is I never take off on the concrete. I always take them off on the grass in case something flips over. I mean, usually not going to chew up a props or break an arm or anything if you're on the grass.
That's funny, because on the opposite, I always move them to the concrete to take off.
Really?
Because I don't want to get hung up in the grass.
Yeah, on my hex and my frame wheel, the two that I film with, I don't really care about where I take those off. You know, short grass or on the concrete, but like my V-tails, I always take them off of the grass because I usually beat those pretty hard, and they usually ended up getting broke the last time I flew them. And so when I bring them home, I'm repairing them, and it's kind of like a first maiden every time. So,
right,
you know, those I usually take on the grass because they're made out of ply and quarter inch, you know, dowels, and they break fairly easy. So a flip over on a concrete could cause some problems.
Sure. So. Yeah, I think you kind of nailed the real critical part with the multi-rotors and the GPS stuff and doing your compass calibration and all that stuff. I would imagine if people did that every single time they end up at a new site, we would have a lot less of those flyaway stories, you think?
Yeah, for sure. And honestly, it just reading all of those flyaway stories for me scared me. And so I made it part of my pre-flight ritual is everywhere I go, I do it, you know, I watch my lights. First I do the calibration, then I watch my satellites all link. And then you'll get a flash saying, you know, I've got my satellites. And then a couple minutes later or a couple seconds later, you'll get another flash saying, I know my home position. Sometimes I even, if I miss that home position, if you flip your course lock, home lock switch like four times, it'll reinitialize the home lock spot. So, and sometimes if I initialize it at the car and I do everything and then I'm actually walking someplace, or, you know, like the same thing, like when I filmed it, the couple Olympic spots, where I did my pre-flight check for the first time, or where I put my battery in, isn't always where I was going to take off. And so I would carry it around the pool and stuff like that. So that was one other thing too, is I always did my home lock, course lock, and reinitialized its home position so that if I did return to home, it's returning home to me and not returning home someplace else where I may not be or be able to take it out. So,
no, don't go to the real home. Come back to me.
Don't go to where I plugged you in over there by the pool or in the pool. I want you to return to home where I'm at now. So, yeah,
it's crazy.
I've carried it around a lot, so I always initialize my home spot too.
Yeah, there's just got to be. I've never had a flyaway, but there's got to be a very horrible sinking feeling to watch your several thousand dollar aircraft leaving in a different direction and you have zero control over it. I just couldn't imagine.
Yeah, it's not a great feeling. I've lost a multi-rotor one time when I first got into, when I was fairly new into multi-rotors, and I wasn't into it a whole bunch, you know, only maybe like $150, but just knowing that's not coming back and I'm not going to find it. And if somebody else finds it, they're probably not going to, you know, give it back. So,
no, yeah, so that's a good point. Feeling. Do you put any identifying information like your AMA number or anything like that on your aircraft so that if they are, whether it's a, you know, heli or a plane or a multi-rotor, if it does end up getting lost, that somebody could figure out who you are?
You know, I would bet 50% of my stuff is tagged. I used to put a business card in the battery tray. But now that I think about it, like my new Skywalker isn't, It's not tagged. My new wings probably aren't tagged. I mean, it's a good habit to have. I used to have some labels that I printed off, but I kind of got lazy with that too. But thanks for reminding me.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to start getting some printing out some just labels like you would label file folders with, and putting my, you know, name and phone number on it, or an email address, and just sticking it somewhere. Lately, I've started. I had some labels printed up, some vinyl of my AMA number, and of course my name. You know, I have, you know, the pilot name, Chris CPO Poldervaart, and I've been putting that on my stuff. So if somebody knows what an AMA number is, so somebody in the hobby, really, to be to narrow it down, finds it, they'll at least know how to track me down. But I think I'm going to start trying to find a way to hide in plain sight, because I don't really want it, you know, I don't want a stupid sticker on my nice, you know, fuselage or anything like that. But I do want to find a way to put something on there where if somebody that didn't know anything about the aircraft was kind of looking around at it and looking it over, they might find the information that would help them return it to me. So,
yeah. Label your batteries.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea. Cause cool. Regardless of how stupid you are, you could probably figure out where the battery is. Yeah. So.
Right on. And if you got a battery beeper on it, eventually a battery beeper is going to start beeping and someone's going to try to pull the battery out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I have anything else. I think we covered pretty much everything anything I can think of. So if we miss something,
I'm sure there's more.
Yeah, if we miss something, here's a good opportunity to go out to the voicemail site, leave us a voicemail saying, "Hey, you guys missed this," or "I do this," but that would be a good opportunity to do that.
You've been listening to RC Hangar Time, a podcast dedicated to the RC aircraft hobby. For more info, you can go to our website at www.rchangartime.com or look for us on Facebook at RC Hangar Time. And if you have any questions, please feel free to email us. For Mike, it's mike@rchangartime.com. For Wade, that's wade@rchangartime.com. Dustin, you guessed it, Dustin@rchangartime.com. And for TJ, it's crash@rchangartime.com. What the heck? Anyways, again, thanks for listening and keep flying.